Welcome to Always Searching, the podcast challenging conventional wisdom about health and wellness. I'm your host, Dr. Sarah Lynn Mark. I'm delighted that you're here. My guest today is an award-winning health expert and best-selling author who worked for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, among other exciting positions in the private sector. Welcome to Always Searching, my dear friend, Nicole Kerr.
Oh, aloha, Sarah. It is so nice to hear your voice and connect with you. And thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I am deeply honored and grateful.
Thank you so much, Nicole. And congratulations, your book just soared to number one. So we definitely want to talk about Deathless and learn more. And we're so happy to have you today. You and I have known each other for a very long time. We worked together when I was at HHS. We launched a national bone health campaign. A friendship grew, went to many meetings together. And then we just decided we had to travel the world together. And I realized as we went through Morocco, we tried to get into Southeast Asia until an accident happened.
That's right.
So we had a couple hours there. But we were dealing with so much on our day-to-day lives that we never really talked about some of the experiences that you had as you were navigating your life from age 19 on up. And this is what we're going to also talk about today, which is sort of an important subject in the topic of your book. But to start, let's our team of explorers, our listeners, learn a little bit more about you. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the South in Jackson, Mississippi. So very much Southern, the Bible Belt, a lot of racial tension in that area. But yeah, it was Mississippi.
Did you know when you were a child growing up in Mississippi that you wanted to go in health? And what was the incentive for you to even join the military? Because you became an Air Force cadet.
Yeah, that's because I'm a people pleaser, Sarah.
Number
one person I had to people please was my father. My father was a graduate of the Air Force Academy 1960. So that was the second class. And he wanted one of the four kids, one of me or my siblings, to go to the academy. And I was the one who stood up and said, I'm going to go. And it was not, I had no idea what I was getting into. And it was just so that he would be proud of me. And I look back on that decision now, and I just can't even believe I did it because I was the opposite of military. I was in, programs. I was the head of a teen board. I was National 17 Magazine representative for Mississippi. I was doing all these things that were the complete opposite of that. And it was pure and simple. I was trying to please my father, and I thought that would do it.
Well, first of all, getting into the Air Force Academy is a huge accomplishment. I grew up in Colorado, and I remember several of my classmates wanted to do it. They would have been one of the first classmates of to you, probably. And it was really a significant honor, but it's a very, very different lifestyle, very rigid, very regimented, very stringent. You have such this ebullient personality. What was it like for you when you first came to Colorado Springs?
Well, first of all, the difference in sea level, because Jackson sits
That's
at
true.
Zero.
That's true. You're in the mile high.
7,000 feet.
Yes.
So to try to just breathe there for me
to
was
walk.
Just, more or less run was a challenge, you know. And I think when I went there, I thought I was, in some part of my brain thought I was going to still like a college. So I took, new makeup, a couple of outfits I went and bought,
outfits.
I went ahead.
They tell you about uniforms.
They took it all away from me the first day, except for my bra. And I put this in the book, they even gave me their, I call them granny britches because they had the elasticized waist, but there was no elastic in the legs. So they just kind of,
They were male undergarments to adapt to women's bodies.
Because I was in the sixth class of women. So they were still trying to figure out how to convert uniforms. My pants, I have very long legs. I'm 5'11". And so they didn't have pants long enough for me. So they gave me men's pants and woman's shirt. So our shirts, women's shirts, button the opposite way of men. So inspection, I never had a straight gig line because it would never line up because of the way the pants button and the shirt. So I always got a demerit every time we had inspection for that because my gig line never lined up. And it was just like, I could never explain it. You know, it was like no excuse,
right.
You know?
Right.
So things like that, that you just look back on and you just go, oh my gosh, you know, it wasn't my fault, but yet you get in trouble. And I think that was a lot of it too. There was still a lot of resentment for women being allowed into the military academies,
sure.
Very abusive environment, I would say. And in fact, yesterday I met a woman that was the class of 86 out of the Naval Academy, went into the Marine Corps, and she was just telling me how abusive it was and that she got sent to remedial training because she didn't look good in her uniform.
Oh my goodness.
So, you know, it's been a hard road, I know, for women, and it's still going on, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just learned that the Army redesigned bras, by the way, speaking of bras, and I think there's a new acronym for it, but it's, you know, just the basic necessities so you can do your job well and safely and with quality. When did you know when you got to the Air Force Academy that this may not be the place for you?
Oh, I can tell you the exact moment. Basic training was 6 weeks long. And at 3 weeks, they gave us the opportunity to call home. And I got a 3-minute phone call and my mother answered the phone. And when I heard her voice, I cried for the entire 3 minutes.
Oh,
I didn't get another word out. And
I'm just sobbing.
Yeah. And I actually didn't realize that at the time, but it was a panic attack. And so that's all. I cried. And then I had to hang up. And the officer, you know, over there just said, Kerr, go sit over there until you get it together. And I was just like, I wanted their permission to come home. I wanted them to say, it's okay to come home. And I remember my mother telling me years later, I looked over at your father and I said, what have we done to her? And he just said, she'll be fine. You know, and I wasn't fine. From there on, I had to go to remedial myself. And that was one-on-one, and that was even worse. So, you know, it was not wanting to disappoint people, not wanting to be a failure. All of that was just driving me. But I knew at 3 weeks that this was not for me. Learning how to fire weapons, you know, learning how to kill people. It just is
right,
like,
and
this
you're a health expert.
Yeah. this isn't my kuleana, as we'd say in Hawaii. This isn't what I was born to do. And my soul knew it. My soul knew it. But I persevered through that first year, you know, and it was difficult because as a woman, my height, I stand out anyway. But it's just the power and the control the upper class have, they just beat on you in all the academies as a freshman.
So now I understand, Nicole, why when you got to Hawaii on a visit, you ended up wanting to stay, just, you know, the complete opposite of what you were experiencing in the academy. But the academy also was a powerful place for you. You had a groundbreaking, life-changing experience with a horrific accident. How soon after being at the academy did that accident occur, and can you share with us what happened?
Yeah, it was the beginning of my, what we would normally call a sophomore year, a 3-degree year. Mm-hmm. And it was August the 28th, and we were having a squadron get together to celebrate the new academic year. So it was about 100 people in my squadron. And earlier that day, I had met with the Commandant of Cadets and two other sophomores to address some people that he wanted us to meet to recruit as high schoolers to come into the academy. And they were mostly women. And we were supposed to give our story of how great it was so that they would come. So I had been with him earlier in the day. And then I was late getting to my squadron function, which was at a park outside of the academy. And when I got there, they were playing softball. It was, you know, they had beer available for the cadets to drink. And then as the day wore on, it was time to leave. And I was one of the last ones to leave. And I asked a guy that I didn't know hardly at all. He was a senior, and you only get to have a car when you're a junior or senior. So I asked him for a ride back. And much to my surprise, I never made it back. I didn't realize he had been drinking most of that day. And then he wanted to stop at a bar on the way back to the academy. for another beer. And so he had two more beers. I actually had two beers, which was the first that I had of alcohol that day, and smoked a cigarette. So that would have been what, my third cigarette I smoked in my life, you know, because that was one of my dad's rules, no smoking, drinking, or dating cadets. Mm-hmm. And then he wanted to stop and watch the sunset. And that's when we got back on the road. That's all I remember is getting back on the road. And then I woke up the next day in the ICU at Penrose Community Hospital. And it took 20 years for my memory to come back of what exactly happened. All I remembered were bright white lights. That was it from that moment. And so 10 weeks into the accident, the EMT that was at the volunteer fire department that I credit with helping save my life, he came to my hospital room and actually filled me in on what happened when he got to the scene. And so that gave me some facts. And so I've had to piece this together through medical notes, through police reports, through court reports. In my book, I've used all that information to help solidify my story.
So, Nicole, you had what we would consider a near-death experience, an NDE, if I have that correct.
That's right.
And the premise of your book, which is Breathless, I want to get the full title of it, chronicles this amazing journey that you went through from the moment of your accident to where you are today. First of all, what's the title, the full title of your book?
It's called You Are Deathless. A near-death experience taught me how to fully live and not fear death. So the moment the car went out of control, it hit a boulder, and it was my side of the car in a Corvette convertible that hit the boulder. And so I flew out of the car, and when I now know how I went through the car, but I explain mm-hmm. it all in the book. And I was thrown out of the car, and I was pronounced dead at the scene. A group of bystanders that lived close by came at it when they heard it, and they couldn't get a pulse on me. They no sign of life. So they went and got a blanket and covered me up. And it took about 10 or 15 minutes for the volunteer fire department to get there. And then the rest of the police and other fire units to get there as well. So in that time, I was lifted up by a spirit, kind of like Casper the Ghost. And I remember just coming out of my body and being lifted up, and I could look down and see that my body was just in that ditch. And I was told by this spirit that, first of all, I could hear other voices up there talking. And one of the mm-hmm. main points they said was that the angels in that realm, the spiritual realm, is there to help us, but we have to ask for help. And the second thing was the spirit guide with me told me that I was going to be going back and that I was to tell people not to be afraid of death. Now, this is coming to me 20 years after the wreck, okay? And I'm going, now, how in the world am I supposed to do that, you know? So it's taken me almost another 20 years to realize what that means. And hence the book is me putting it all together and telling people that the moment of death is there's no pain, there's no loneliness, it is beautiful, and there's nothing to be afraid of, nothing at all.
So when you, just to backtrack for a second, when you were in the car and you were heading towards that boulder, do you recall that you were going to hit that boulder and this was it? Did you have a sense of fear? Have any of those emotions come back to you?
Yes, they've come back in the last 10 years. And mm-hmm. I can remember how 20 years ago when my memory came back, that's when I was working at CDC, mm-hmm. was at Starbucks. And then all of a sudden I could just see how I went through the windshield, and I couldn't ever figure out how I basically amputated my left foot and cut up all the insides of my leg. I had a fourth degree laceration between my anal and sphincter. A huge chunk of skin came out of the inside of my thigh. So I completely cut up that whole area in between my legs. And then my wrist was severed. And then I had a really bad road burn from skidding on the pavement. And then I broke both sides of my pelvis. So I couldn't figure out how my brain and my spinal cord were saved. And then I realized I could see myself in the car. One foot was on the Corvette convertible. I was in the seat, and my right leg was stretched out and my left leg was folded over kind of in a triangle. You know how you fold your leg over and hit it, you know, put it on your knee. And so that's how I went up through the windshield, is in that position. And that's why I cut where I cut. And when that memory came back, I just went, oh boy, I'm not going to work. I went to see my chiropractor. He was completely booked that day. And I sat in his office all day and waited for him to see me, because I was so shook up. And that's called repressed memories. And I had never heard about that. And now I know when your body feels safe enough, trauma can come back up when you can deal with it.
You can face it.
Yeah.
So when you, do you remember hitting the ground? Do you remember any sense of pain?
Nope.
Do you remember thinking, this is it?
I do remember later that when I like got stuck up in the air, which is, I would say, my time on the other side, but I knew when I hit the ground that I was going to die. I just knew it.
And you consciously knew that.
Yeah. And I did.
And you said you saw like a Casper the ghost. It's a cartoon for some folks who aren't familiar with Casper. What did you see? Was it just white light? Was it an image?
It was like a spirit, like a form, but it didn't have like an outline like you would think. It was, I could feel it. I could hear it. I could sense it. I could hear these other voices, and they were all communicating with each other, but it wasn't a defined shape, I should say, like we would know. But it was soothing. I didn't want to come back, because I knew if I came back in that body, it was going to be a lot of pain and suffering. Mm-hmm. And it has been for me, you know, for a lot of my life, whether it was physical and then emotional. And of course, the spiritual part, being raised in a really religious home, the whole bit about blaming who's responsible and, you know, what I did wrong was really a hard one for me to move through and release.
So you've talked about that with me, about this sense of guilt and that the relationship you had with your family afterwards. What happened there, and how did you move through that?
Well, I think my case was so severe. I was in the hospital. Well, I was in ICU for 7 weeks, and then I was in the hospital for 4 months, and I was literally on a roller coaster. I had two code blues that at one point they had already called the time of expiration on me and went to tell my parents that I had, you know, passed on, and to get funeral
preparations. And this was while you were in the hospital, you were arrested.
Yeah. And so my mother wouldn't believe it. My dad started crying. She said that's the first time she's ever seen him cry. And then a surgical nurse ran in and said, oh, they got her going again. So Sarah, I tried to leave a couple of times. I really did.
It sounded like you had like three cardiac arrests, something like that.
I didn't really want to stay, because I just knew how difficult this would be, especially being raised Southern Baptist and Lutheran. And what I realized on the other side was the God that I had been raised with, this duality of God is love, but God is also punishing, judgmental, keeping score, causes things to happen if you don't follow the rules. That was total BS. That is man-made fear, and it doesn't exist. That is not God at all. God is pure love, period. And that, I think, has been the hardest thing, because my parents are still steeped in religions that believe that, you know, duality, and preach that. And it's very difficult to try to have a conversation with someone who is adamant that the Bible is the one and only way, and you have to go through Jesus in order to get to God. Well, we are all God, you know, we're all one. And it's an experience that most people that have NDEs, you realize love is all that matters, and it's the source of all that exists. And we're all connected, and that loving ourselves and others is the most important thing we can do. We're never alone. We're never judged. You know, and that's a big one, never judged, because that's a lot of the religion, is you're going to be judged. And so that keeps you in fear, which keeps you from really living your life. So I don't really have much of a relationship with my parents anymore, because my dad just even recently told me that I don't believe in NDEs because they're not in the Bible. So I'm just like, you're totally discounting me as your daughter, as a person, lack of respect. And I'm thinking, didn't Lazarus die and come back? But I don't know, maybe not. But it's just really sad. But that is, I'm not writing this book for my family. I'm writing it for other people to see what happens and what you can have to go through to transform yourself, you know, and to erase belief systems that are operating you, that are actually sabotaging you from being the being that you were created to be.
So Nicole, it sounds like you were told by your spiritual guides that you were going to come back and help share messages of love and not to have fear. You've been involved as a private practitioner for a technique called neuroemotional technique.
Right. NET. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me what that is? How did you get into it? And how has that helped you? Because I think we also have to help ourselves before we can help others.
Absolutely. And writing this book has helped heal me. But I came across NET about 7 years ago when I was in Hawaii as the wellness director at one of the hospitals. And what I realized is, it was a chiropractor, and he said, I was belching. And I was like, I don't drink beer, and I don't have, the gastroenterologist just was like, Nicole, I don't know what's wrong with you, but I just belched. I sound like a seal. And I thought, this is not right. And he told me it was emotional. And I said, what? And he said, Nicole, it's emotions. And they're coming out in various forms physically. And so I've been working with that technique, which is a mind-body stress relief technique. And it uses acupuncture points. It uses muscle testing, psychology. And it's not invasive, but it really does help you get at the unconscious emotions that you have never let yourself feel. And then what happens is you clear it. And so present day, when something triggers you, and especially if you have PTSD, if you get triggered, your amygdala instantly fires on. I mean, that prefrontal cortex, that amygdala just hijacks it. You know, you're right back at 19 or whatever age that event happens that was very similar to what's happening in the present day, and you're reacting from a 17-year-old or a 19-year-old response, you know? So it helps clear that emotion out. And I think one of the biggest things I had to learn was I was very disconnected from my body. I could intellectualize things, and I could process in terms of my mind, like, oh yes, feeling. I should be angry at this man for being drunk, you know? I should be angry that he got away with it because his dad was a 3-star general. And yes, I'm angry, but my body, like, I cut it off at my neck and didn't let my body feel it and integrate it. And what is now, you know, becoming more and more of a bigger issue for people is embodying emotions. And we all have stuck emotions. So it's really important in that wheel of wellness. You know, we've stayed stuck on the physical. Oh, let me tell you what to eat. Let me tell you physical activity, all that kind of stuff. And then the mental is showing up in our society even more with all the gun violence, right? We're seeing that. Mm-hmm. And then the emotional is really not dealt with in most wellness centers, and definitely the spiritual. And I've done all three components now, the physical, the mental, the emotional, and I still have to work on that. It doesn't mean, I mean, I'm human. I have to still deal with it in the human world, but exactly. It's the spiritual piece now that I'm in alignment with, that I feel like I'm ready now to deal with that message and help people alleviate their fears about death, because most of them are not true.
So do you think, if you were to step back, that the experience you had at the Air Force Academy was almost preordained in a way so that you could come back and be a messenger?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And does that take some of the edge off of what you've experienced and gone through for all these decades, the physical and the emotional and the spiritual challenges?
Yeah, I think it had to take that level for mm-hmm. me to be able to change courses.
Mm-hmm. Course correct.
Yeah.
Please everybody but yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a real common mm-hmm. identity that especially women take on, is people pleasing. Yeah. And at mm-hmm. the end of the day, you are not served at all by it.
So what do you do in your life now that gives you joy, that gives you a sense of purpose? We're all teachers. We do what we can, but just internally, what do you do to stay centered?
Well, I do a lot of energy work. I think that's important too, because
can you explain what that, a lot of people use that term, but a lot of people don't know what it means. Can you describe what is energy work?
Yeah, well, we're all energy, if you think about it, you know, mm-hmm. Your breath, when you think about dying, your soul and your spirit lift out of you. That's like a vapor, right? An energy form lifting out of you. So it connects and goes where it needs to go. But everything is energy. And so when you come up against another person and they're very negative, you feel that negative energy, right? Coming mm-hmm. off of them. Mm-hmm. And if you're not careful, you let it come on to you. You may be feeling fine. And then all of a sudden, after talking to them, you're going, yeah, you get negative too. And
we call those emotional vampires.
Yes. Yeah, but it's true. And so in order to help with your own energy and to make sure that you're not bogged down taking on other people's energy and, trying fix them, control them, all that kind of stuff. You have to keep your energy clear. And there's a lot, it's a new field that's opened up and a lot of work about how you can do just simple things to clear your energy, you know, to put yourself in a container when you go out so you don't take on other people's energy. Because especially if you're an empathic person, a sensitive person, mm-hmm. People will feel that and just mm-hmm. want to glob onto you.
So how does someone once described it as having like a white bubble of light around them to kind of sort of allow them to be there, but kind of have a force shield in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great way. Or like putting up, like a fence around you, a white picket fence, but interlace roses around it. You know, it's like, you're still loving, but it's like, whoa, you have to start getting good with boundaries as well. But it's making sure that you are clear with yourself in terms of energy and think about your day. Did I pick up something from somebody that's not mine? You know, and I think a lot of us go through our day and don't even realize that we've done that. But especially if you're, you know, in that category of sensitives, it's so easy to do because you want to help people and you take it on yourself.
Nicole, can you share with us some of the key bullets in your book about how people need to think about death?
Sure. I would say the first one is to understand that you don't die, in quotes, that your spirit, your soul live on. It has a long trajectory. Okay. I would also say that the most important thing that matters in this lifetime is to learn to love yourself and then expand that love. And if you have, I know for me, it's my doggies. I just adopted two Pekingese 2 years ago, and one of them is handicapped, and they are just a delight. And I know, Sarah, you have Lucy.
I do. Our little angels.
Yes, yes. And they're just such unconditional love. And mm-hmm. it helps you to expand your heart even mm-hmm. more when I think you really have this relationship with your animals. And all sentient beings, you know, and that we're all connected. And in this time of where we're at in this day and age on this planet, there's a lot of divisiveness going on. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of negativity. Yeah. And we need to remember that we're all connected. Everything and everyone is connected. And that is a truth. And when we meet people, to remember that instead of judging them, instead of trying to use your power over them in a negative way. You know, we truly, our souls and our spirit are perfect. You know, our physical nature is not to come here to be perfect. And I think that's a lot of things that especially women get caught in is perfectionism. And there's no way to reach that. So let yourself off the hook with that. Okay. Mm-hmm. And to be kinder to yourself and to embrace the body that you have and quit picking at yourself. Cause I did that for so long. You know, I hated my body because I had all these scars, mm-hmm. you know, I used to model and now I was just like, you know, oh my God, nobody's going to want me, you know, but that was the conditioning that you had to look a certain way in order for someone to want you, you know? And that's what you have to evolve beyond and realize I love myself no matter what anybody thinks. And that's the joy that comes. And it's just been a journey for me to have to shed these ascribed identities and to come into this and bloom and just really own that it's all within. I used to think God was external, that my happiness was external. It's not. It's all internal. And that's all part of the book. And I share from my heart. I mean, I really do. I put myself out there in this book. I'm very vulnerable. I talk about having an eating disorder, which for a lot of women, it's very shameful to admit that because it's a very secretive disease, but that's about hating yourself. You know, there's pain in you. And I talk about my family. I talk about religion and Southern Baptist and Lutheran and just, you know, our views about God. And my experience on the other side was that wasn't true at all. And now, you know, you're hearing about the sexual abuse coming out in the Southern Baptist Church with the Mormons. And it's just like, oh my gosh, you know.
So how are you finding people respond to your book? Are you getting an embrace? Have you had any pushback?
Well, not yet, because it's only been out since the 11th, and it went to the number one NDE book in a week without any promotion. They were just
really
doing this.
Remarkable.
They went through a soft launch. And mm-hmm. what I'm people that I know that have texted me, they are just amazed at how the story flows, how I intersperse humor in it, as well as science, as well as, you know, pictures that help tell the story. You know, yes. When you see the car in.
Yeah, that was remarkable.
Yeah. You go, how did anybody survive this? And exactly. It's just like, you know, I didn't do this. Spirit did it. I didn't pull myself back and put myself, you know, in the hospital. Something greater than that did that, you know. And just like going to number one, I believe that's all. This is all part of the message. And when you're on your path and purpose, and it just the doors just open up, and I'm just watching it, and I'm speechless. I really am, because I'm like, I can't believe this, you know. But I'm excited, and most of all, I just hope it helps people. You know, mm-hmm. that's been my whole intention, is that it's effective in helping people deal with their fears and give them some tools and help them to talk about this and not just keep it silent within them. Because I think when we all can discuss what our fears are with death and about our concept of God and where we go from here, it makes us think, it makes us lose that fear of it, you know, and That's what I hope. And so I've coined a new term for myself, and it's eternality advocate, and that we are everlasting.
Well, the eternal aspect certainly plays a major role. Where can one find a copy of your book?
They can find it on Amazon. Right now it's on Kindle version and paperback. A hard copy is coming out hopefully next week. And then retail stores will be carrying hopefully in the next week as well.
Well, Nicole, I've been in many meetings with you, and I've noticed whenever you walked into a room, your light radiated. And so I'm sure your book is going to do that for so many people. I just want to thank you for joining us. I wish you good health, and I'm so honored that you are willing to share your story with us today.
Oh, Sarah, thank you so, so much. I really appreciate you and love you, my dear, and the same for you.
And until next time, we're always searching. Thank you so much for listening to Always Searching. Please share it with your community. This podcast was produced by Noah Jones and hosted by me, Dr. Sarah Lynn Mark. Until next time, we're always searching.